You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that because you're already listening to a podcast.
This is the Useless Information Podcast. I am Steve Silverman.
Useless information.
Everyone, welcome to the latest episode of the Retrocast. Today I have my wife, Mary Jane, joining us.
Hi, everybody.
And I've had a lot of problem with the microphones, as I've mentioned in previous podcasts. What I've done is I've actually opened up her mic a bit, so it lets a little bit more static in. So I have to apologize for that in advance, but we're going to try and get through this and see how it works out. If you guys on the other end are hearing a lot of static, just let me know and we'll try and tweak it. I figure it'll get a little bit better over time. Anyway, what we're going to do is we've decided we're just going to alternate the stories. Usually I read them all. You're going to take one, I'll take one, and so on.
Sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. And the first three stories, which are the ones I've actually researched, these all have something to do with lingerie.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. And the reason for that is it actually ties in with the retro sponsor they're going to play in a bit. I actually had two lingerie stories. I had to dig up a third, so I did some searching. And actually, the one that I found last is the one I'm going to read first. So here we go. You ready?
Sure. Let's go.
Okay, so the first story for today takes place in 1907 in Muskogee, which was back then in 1907 part of what was called Indian Territory. 4 months later, become part of the state of Oklahoma. Anyway, kind of give a little background before I tell this story, and that is that in 1802, the Indian Non-Intercourse Act and its various amendments that came after it, it made it illegal to sell or offer to sell alcohol anywhere within Indian Territory or to Native Americans themselves. Now, without going into the rationale for this, basically, the introduction of alcohol into Native American culture was a disaster, and that's right. Why this went into place. I'm sure there were other reasons for it, but that's the main reason. Anyway, so without going into the exact details of the Indian Non-Intercourse Act, it did carve out exceptions for the white man. Basically, it could be sold and consumed by the white man and in the white communities, but not to Native Americans.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, one of these towns was Keystone, which is a real rough and tumble saloon town, which is about 17 miles or 28 kilometers northeast of Tulsa. And when I say rough and tumble, I mean it was everything, gambling, prostitution, and so on.
Right. No law.
Yeah, basically. And the town no longer exists, and that's because it was drowned by the waters of the Arkansas River in 1962 because they built the dam. And, of course, it became a reservoir, and now the entire town is underwater. Anyway, at the turn of the 20th century, Oklahoma was the largest producing oil state in the United States. It would alternate back and forth between California and Oklahoma. If you're drilling a lot of oil, obviously a lot of men come into the area to drill that oil. And naturally, that also meant a lot of demand for alcohol.
Now, money. They have money. They can.
Right.
They want to have some fun.
But the problem was, of course, the Indian Non-Intercourse Act forbid the sale of alcohol outside of the white community. These guys are working out in the fields on the oil rigs. So they were expected to hop on their horses. Really, this is 1907. They really had to get on their horses and go all the way, to one of the wet towns. So they realized, if they can't go get the alcohol, someone's going to bring the alcohol to them. So an illegal trade, grew out of that. And, basically, they'd bring the alcohol from Keystone along what was called the Keystone Trail down to the oil field for the workers. But as you know, with any illegal trade comes hijacking, robbery, and all that kind of stuff. So soon the law began to, crack down on the smugglers. But no matter how hard they tried, the alcohol continued to get through. And that's no different than the drug trade today. I mean, no matter how hard they try, the drugs still manage to get through. Anyway, this is the real story that I was going to tell, and that is on July 13th in 1907, Deputy Marshal Dan Parker began talking about how, and this is in quotes, two handsome women, you never use that term today, but two handsome women who had been driving a wagon along the Keystone Trail, he stopped to talk to them, and he didn't really suspect anything until one of the women offered to sell him some whiskey. So he stated, yeah, I'll buy it, you know, what the heck. And then she showed him, of course, the goods, and he placed the two women immediately under arrest. And he was pretty happy because he had uncovered a new method. No one ever suspected that women would be the ones, moving the alcohol. Right, exactly. So anyway, the women were very cooperative, and they, you know, didn't put up a fight or anything, but they told Parker they needed to get out of their fancy clothes before they went into town. So he was a very polite guy. He was very nice. He went into the woods, and he waited there a little bit while they were behind their wagons changing their clothes.
Sure.
And you know exactly where this is going. After a few minutes, he's like, what's taking so long? And he went, of course, they were long gone. They took to the bushes also.
You also wonder what the excuse was for changing their clothes. I mean, that's a little strange.
Yeah, I don't know. Got me. Anyway, so Parker took the immediate steps to legally arrest. That was the term they used at the time. I think today we call it seizure. Mm-hmm. He seized the corsets, the petticoats, the lingerie, the alcohol, their wagons, their horses, and just about everything else that they had left behind. And then he, of course, hopped on his wagon and headed for Muskogee, but the prisoners got away. He never caught them. Now, the two parts that I want to conclude on this is that Parker did manage to uncover a smuggling technique that no one had ever suspected before, the use of women to transport the goods. But he managed to make the national newspapers under the headlines, Arrested Corsets.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the lingerie.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it's the best of the three stories I put together for today, but, it was kind of...
Well, it's interesting that that's where the attention was placed on corsets, not, you know, the fact that he, you know, had discovered this way of transporting.
It's typical of the newspapers always, you know, put the headline on
the
it.
The sensationalized kind
right, exactly.
of information.
Yeah. Okay, so now you're up. You're going to read one.
Okay, this one, the title is Lingerie Rummage Sale Fails. On Wednesday evening, April 30th, 1952, a water fight broke out between students at a male dormitory and those at a neighboring fraternity house at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, Nebraska. It wasn't long before things escalated out of control. The students then made their way to a sorority house where house mother Mrs. Mary Buckingham attempted to keep the boys out. She was unsuccessful. The boys pushed her aside, leaving her with bruises and a wrenched back. Once inside, they pilfered every piece of lingerie that they could find. Next, they did the same at the women's dormitory and every other sorority house. At its peak, more than 400 male students were involved, and the female students were left with no undergarments other than what they were wearing at the time.
Okay.
Damage was estimated at $700. That's nearly $7,000 adjusted for inflation, which included the stolen lingerie and some broken furniture in the sorority houses. A second disturbance occurred the following evening. An estimated 100 male students raided the sorority houses. As the young women piled out of the buildings, they were soaked with water and paint was spattered on the back of their jeans. Dean of Students Affairs T.J. Thompson and campus police attempted to bring calm to the mob. They responded by treating Thompson the same. As he was talking with reporters, a group of boys doused him with water. Most of these boys out here, Thompson told the press, are not university students, but high school boys and local residents. During the final moments of the disturbance, a number of the male students moved on to the women's dormitory, where they ripped a window screen from the building, damaged an iron door, and splattered mud on the facade. So what do you do with a huge pile of women's lingerie? The male students came up with a unique plan. They advertised that there would be a rummage sale of choice lingerie in the campus newspaper. They weren't looking to sell any of it. Their goal was to get the women to come over to the male dormitory and claim their unmentionables. On May 3rd, tables were set up outside the male dormitory and the lingerie was placed on display. Their rummage sale was a complete failure. Only six girls showed up and not a single undergarment was claimed. One male student commented, "We've got this stuff now and we can't get rid of it." At a student convocation on Tuesday, May 13th, 1952, University Chancellor R.J. Gustavsson stated that 75 male students had been identified as having participated in the raids on the women's dormitory and the sororities. Each had been placed on conduct probation and forbidden from participating in any extracurricular activities. They had been warned that if they committed another infraction of university rules, they would be expelled. He stated, "It is our hope that all active participants will eventually be identified. Everyone will recognize, of course, the difficulty in identifying all those who took part. Students identified as active members of the raiding party have been asked to pay damages."
Do you have any comments on that?
Well, you know, at first I didn't know whether to laugh or be upset, but I did do a little reading on really what was called panty raids in the 1950s, and you know, they stated that in fact it was very common, and sometimes the girls were in on it. Maybe not this particular one because it was one of the first, but it is said that it had to do with the curfews. The boys and the girl students did not like that they had curfews, that they were not allowed into the dorms. So it was a form of protest, actually.
Mm-hmm. As you know, I have folders everywhere.
Sure, you do.
You know, story after story after story, and piles of possible stories. So one of them is labeled panty raids. Yeah. You know, years ago, I was thinking maybe that'd be a good story. But, it just seemed like one that was too well known and, I don't know, maybe a little bit too salacious, you know.
Well, I mean, it's historical, you know. And the only thing that was really harmful in this is, you know, it sounds like the person guarding the door, the dorm mother was hurt a little, which is not good, of course, but it's kind of humorous almost.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to the last story that I researched for today. And this one is about the band Alice Cooper. Remember them?
Yes, I do.
Most famous song was "School's Out."
"School's Out," I love that.
Yeah,
kids still do love it.
Oh, yeah,
around June. I don't know why.
Yeah, in Chatham, just a little before I get into the story, in Chatham, where I taught for 30 years, they have a PA system, of course, all the announcements on. Yeah. It has the worst sound in the world. I mean, you do not play music on this. And actually, on the older system, it was even worse before they replaced it. And every year on the last day of school, when the last bell would ring, they'd play "School's Out."
I think that's great.
Yeah, but you could hardly recognize it. If you didn't know the song, you'd hardly know that's what was being played. But
that's a really bad PA system.
Yeah. Anyway, this story is from June 19th of 1972, and it regards a unique promotion that the band Alice Cooper had been staging at the time. This one's actually pretty famous. I don't know if you know it. Their latest album at the time, which just happened to be "School's Out," had the image of an old wooden desk on the front. As you opened the album, you lifted the cover. The front of the desk would actually lift up. The wooden top would lift up. And then, of course, that would reveal the contents of the desk. And I just looked at the image quickly. There were pencils, crayons, erasers, marbles, a "School's Out" quiz, a slingshot. Everybody had a pocket knife in their desk, right? Wow. Today, if you were caught with one, you'd
today.
Be suspended.
That would be bad.
Yeah.
Impossible.
Superintendent's hearing for sure. Now, the album cover was designed by a guy named Craig Braun, and he's the same guy who worked with Andy Warhol to design the Rolling Stones Sticky Fingers album. Do you know about that album?
I know it by title. I can't visualize what the cover looks like.
Yeah, if you saw it, you definitely would know, because it's one of the, I'd say it's infamous, because
it sounds infamous.
Yeah, well, anything from the Rolling Stones, you know, back then, probably. Anyway, it's basically a male model's crotch. That's all basically from the stomach down to the top of the legs in tight blue jeans, and you can see a little bit of the private part there. And what was most famous about this album was it had a real working zipper on it.
Goodness. So
you'd pull it down and you
the 1970s, right?
Yeah, this is early 1970s. Yeah,
of course.
I want to say that album maybe came. Someone's going to tell me I'm way wrong on this. I'm just assuming it's from memory. I think it might be 1971 that album came out.
Okay.
But anyway, maybe 1972. But anyway, when you open the zipper, it would reveal. It would just flip back a little bit, and you could see the underwear, and then it had Andy Warhol's signature under there.
Oh, okay.
That was basically it. The biggest problem with these albums were. That when they shipped them to stores, the zipper would actually damage one of the tracks. So the solution to it was they actually had to unzip them all, pull the zipper down, and then it wouldn't hit the record where it would damage any of the tracks on the record. Yeah. But anyway, that's a very famous song. So the same guy worked on "School's Out" by Alice Cooper. Now, as unusual as the album cover was, what really made this famous was inside. And that's because lead singer Alice Cooper, his original name was Vincent Furnier, and he always said one of the smartest things he ever did is he changed his name to Alice Cooper. So when the band broke up, he still legally had possession of that name. But anyway, Alice Cooper came with the idea of doing away with the protective record sleeve. Remember years ago when you got a record, it went into a paper sleeve and then it went into the cover? Anyway, he came with the idea of doing away with that and wrapping the record in a pair of disposable paper panties.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was part of their promotion. Now, the panties were manufactured in England and they were shipped to the U.S. and then they were distributed to record manufacturing plants in California, Illinois, and New Jersey in alphabetical order there. And everything went well for the first 250,000 copies, but the album was a smash hit. So they ordered an additional 500,000 pair of the paper panties, and that's when U.S. Customs got involved and stopped their shipment. It turns out that the panties failed to pass the Federal Trade Commission's flammable fabrics test.
Not a censorship. It really was a problem.
They tested 5 pairs and determined they all burst into flames in 3.5 seconds after being subjected to the heat of a special oven that they used. So Ashley Pandel, an official at Alice Cooper's management firm, which was called Alive Enterprises, argued that the paper panties were intended as packing material and were never intended to be worn. And of course, if that's the case, then they shouldn't be subjected to the test. But to counter that argument, FTC spokesman Edward B. Finch pointed out that the paper panties were imported. They were labeled as being women's apparel, and therefore there was no guarantee that a woman wouldn't put them on. So therefore, they were subject to the test and couldn't be allowed to be imported.
It sounds like censorship.
Yeah, well, maybe.
But anyway.
It could be. Anyway, the record company came up with a perfect solution. They would just spray all the paper panties with a flame retardant, and then there wouldn't be a problem. Alice Cooper, that's the man, commented, quote, "I know we're hot right now, but I never thought our panties would catch fire."
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I should add, they also did enough to keep the stunt going because they were receiving so much publicity from the paper panties. They were doing a concert at the Hollywood Bowl in California, and they had an audience of 18,000. They had a helicopter fly over, and they dropped panties down onto the audience. You know, get yourself in the news one more time.
Right.
Now, I know you really want a pair of these, don't you?
Oh.
Yeah. Anyway, the good news is that Friday Music recently reissued the vinyl album, Paper Panties and All. The selling price is $34.98. And even better, they have a limited deluxe edition that comes with a report card, which is really just a track listing with the times, a hall pass, a tattoo, a couple of trading cards with a band on it, and of course, your choice of white or pink panties. And that'll only set you back an additional $14.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So the reason I did these three stories on lingerie is because I actually found, it's in many places on the internet, I found the commercial, one of the ads for the Alice Cooper album. So let's listen to that.
Sure. Okay.
Hey, troglodytes.
Not about a woman.
Have you seen Alice Cooper's panties yet? Alice Cooper's new School's Out album, complete with lace panties, now especially priced at Sears.
Hot pants.
Plus Jimmy Castor's Fun Troglodyte album.
Come here.
And special low prices on Elvis's Live at Madison Square Garden. Simon and Garfunkel's Greatest Hits. Plus new albums by The Carpenters, Neil Diamond, Free, Derek and the Dominoes, New Riders of the Purple Sage, and the new Live at London album by Chuck Berry.
She threw out all her money at the Southern Trust.
Albums and tapes, including Alice's lace panties, now especially priced at Sears. Pull them on.
LPs start at $333. 8-track tapes start at $488. Sale ends Saturday.
Okay, I don't know about you, but I thought that commercial was a bit harsh on my ears.
Well, it's advertising.
Yeah. And what really surprised me is that it was Sears.
I agree. I had no idea they had it. Well, I don't recall a music section at Sears.
Yeah. Of course, in the day, Sears sold everything.
Yeah. Big department store.
Yeah. I remember as a kid, the nearest Sears to me was probably more than a half hour drive away from my parents' house. So we would go to a local department store called James Way, which is long out of business, but they had a small little record section and you'd go in there and they'd have, you know, maybe one aisle and they have bins on both sides of the aisle and you'd, you know, pick out you know, they didn't have much of a selection, but for the average person, it's just buying the hits or a greatest hits album.
Records were sold everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I did look up the price on this, and they said in the ad that the album started at $3.33. Now I looked that up, adjusted for inflation, that's over $20 today, which seems like a lot of money to me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, kids were buying albums. Where were they getting that kind of money? They were buying lots, actually.
Yeah, I don't know where they were getting that kind of money. Now, that is tied to the Consumer Price Index, so it's not like someone just made these, you know, these numbers out of nowhere.
Right.
I mean, over $20 for a single album is it's
steep. It sounds kind of steep.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I do have a question for you.
All right.
About 5 years ago, I'm sure you recall this, we took a former student of mine, Sadie Kratch, who's graduating high school. And as a graduation gift, we took her down to the original site where the Woodstock Festival was held in 1969.
Yes.
And it's a lot different than it was years ago. They've actually built a beautiful amphitheater called Bethel Woods there. And what's most interesting is they have a Woodstock Museum, which I thought I'd be very disappointed in, but it was actually really nice museum. I was very impressed. I wouldn't go hundreds of miles out of your way to go to this museum, but if you're in the area in the Catskill Mountains, I would definitely recommend
it's
going
worth
there.
It.
It definitely was worth it. So my question for you here is there were 29 acts that played Woodstock. They were paid, you know, to come on stage and perform. So who was the highest paid act at Woodstock? And since you probably don't, you know, there's so many acts that played there, I'm going to give you a multiple choice out of five choices.
I love multiple choice.
Okay. So here we go. And these are in alphabetical order. No other order other than alphabetical.
Okay. So I won't overanalyze.
Right.
Okay.
So was it one, Creedence Clearwater Revival? Mm-hmm. Two, The Grateful Dead?
Okay.
Three, Jimi Hendrix? Mm-hmm. Four, Santana?
Yep.
Or five, The Who? So which one of those was the highest paid act? Now, don't give your answer now.
I won't.
I'll reveal it at the end of the podcast.
Okay.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas. Plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Now we're going to move on to a section that I've been calling Footnotes History. These are short little stories that really there's no further research to do, and we're just going to read them word for word, and I'll do the first one.
Okay.
This one's dated December 19th of 1935, and is titled Phone Girl Hurt in Freak Auto Accident. San Jose. Miss Josephine Morgan, telephone operator, was in a hospital today with a local nomination for Victim of the Year's Strangest Accident. She parked her automobile and opened the door. The door struck a lamppost. As she stepped to the curb, the globe of the street lamp crashed on her head and left her unconscious. Although fears were first expressed that she received a fractured skull, she's reported not seriously injured today.
Okay, this is from June 6th, 1938, and the headline is, Salon Man Claims Fish Milked Cow. Okay. From Sandusky, Michigan, comes the year's strangest fish story. It involves a former Salon Saskatchewan man, Russell Ostick, who surprised a fish milking a cow and later removed a pound and a half of butter from the fish. Ostick and the story was published in the Sandusky Republican Tribune, found one of his Guernsey cows standing in a water-filled pasture after a heavy rain. When the cow did not move for some time, Ostick went closer and found it was being milked by a fish. Ostick then caught the fish and found the butter inside it. It's an odd story, but in closing it, the newspaper said, "This newspaper has heard about fish stories, but without a doubt, this is one fish story that is true. At least Mr. Ostick says so." Mr. Ostick is well known in the Ceylon district south of Regina, and among his many friends there is J.T. Meredith, who says that if Mr. Ostick says it happened, it happened.
So what do you think of that fish story? I just don't buy it.
Yeah, I even checked to see if it was on April 1st that it was written, but of course, as I said, it was June. I just... How is that possible?
Yeah.
Especially the creating butter. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Every once in a while, I mean, I print out a lot of these stories. As you know, wouldn't know this, but basically before I go to bed every night, I have a laptop and I just sit there and I just look for little
crazy
stories. I mean, every once in a while, one of them turns into a big story that I'll do the podcast on, but I'll have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these little stories.
Right.
And every once in a while, there's ones like that one really,
right.
And that really sounds fishy, which really applies to the story.
And I mean, okay, possibly butter, but a pound and a half. Crazy. Too crazy.
Yeah, it's. I mean, he could have mistaken the fat in the fish for butter, but I just don't buy it.
Yeah, and even that a fish ended up in a water-filled pasture. I mean, I don't know. It's just really out there.
It's a fish story.
Okay.
Our next story is dated October 9th of 1940, and is titled "Perfect Host Gets Prison Term." Syracuse, New York, October 9th, United Press. Playing the part of the perfect host resulted in a 3-month penitentiary sentence for Wayman G. Woody of this city. He was arrested when friends reported to police that while his wife was entertaining them at supper, Woody looted their home. Persuaded by his wife to return the stolen articles, Woody told his friends he did it for a joke. Sentence was imposed, however, when Judge Homer V. Walsh found he had previous petty larceny convictions against his record. So can you imagine that?
He stole from friends.
Yeah, basically his wife has people over the house, and then he sneaks off and he's robbing their homes. I just thought that was kind of interesting.
Creative.
Yeah, very creative.
Maybe,
although
maybe not successful, but creative.
Of course, he ended up in jail for 3 months.
All right, this is from December 13th, 1949, and the headline is "Freak Fire." Bridgeport, Connecticut, December 13th, a box of cookies set fire to a house. Here's how. The box toppled from a kitchen shelf onto the handle of a water faucet, turning on the water. The cookies spilled out and clogged the drain. The sink overflowed, the water seeped through the floor, a short circuit resulted, and the fire broke out.
Yeah, sounds a bit like a Rube Goldberg type contraption. You know, the cookies fall into the sinks, turns the water on, water then seeps, I don't know, into the basement, a crawl space, shorts out the electric, and burns the house.
I could imagine it, though, because honestly, sinks get clogged very easily. You drop a top or something right over that area, and it can be clogged pretty easily, definitely with cookie dough, I would think.
Yeah. So, anyway, I thought that was a cute little story.
Yeah, it's more believable than the fish one.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely.
Definitely. Okay, and the last little short story I have here is from January 19th of 1967. It's titled, "Stick 'Em Up, He Only Wanted $10. This is from Calgary, Alberta, and is reported by the Associated Press. Richard Irvin Clark, owner of a Calgary auto body shop, went to his bank to withdraw $10 yesterday, but made an unlucky choice of withdrawal slips. This is actually a pretty good story. I like this one. Clark, 48, filled out the slip and took it to the teller. On the back, she found a note, quote, "This is a stick-up. Empty the till." Hmm. The teller went to another employee who pressed a button summoning the police. Meanwhile, Clark took the slip to another teller who didn't see the note on the back and gave him $10. As Clark left the bank, police followed him and picked him up.
For the $10.
Yeah, well, no, for sticking up the bank.
Right.
After questioning him for 3 hours, they released him, and a spokesman said, quote, "Some clown must have written the note." Returning to his car from the police station, Clark found it had been towed away for overtime parking. But when he explained what had happened, he didn't have to pay to get it back.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Still working the system a bit.
Yeah. So make sure when you go to the bank, you flip over the deposit slip. Make sure it's not a stick up note.
Right.
So earlier I'd asked, what was the highest paid act at the Woodstock concert in 1969? I gave you five choices.
It
was
you did.
Yes. Creedence Clearwater Revival, The Grateful Dead, Jimi Hendrix, Santana, or The Who. Which one did you choose?
Can I break it down? I'm thinking of two possible.
Okay, ones. What do you think?
I'm thinking Jimi Hendrix.
Okay.
And The Who.
Okay.
Do I have a 50% chance of being right?
You have a 50% chance of getting them right. Okay. So now
can
you got to
tell you my logic.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think of Jimi Hendrix possibly being very famous at that point.
Sure.
And The Who as being a foreign band, right?
Right. But the Who were very popular at that time also.
Right.
Okay. So you're ready?
Do I have to choose?
Well, of course.
Let me choose.
It's a multiple choice quiz.
I'm close, right? I'm awfully
close. Yeah, it's
close.
One of the
I've
two.
I've got 50% chance. I'm going to say Jimi Hendrix.
You are correct.
Yay!
Jimi Hendrix was the highest paid act at Woodstock. Although I did watch an American Experience documentary on Woodstock last summer.
Mm-hmm.
And he played, but there was nobody there. By the time he got on stage, he was the headlining act. By the time he got on stage,
it was late at night or something.
No, it had rained so much, almost everybody had left.
Everybody had left. Oh my gosh!
And I guess the joke is, if you say you saw Jimi Hendrix playing, you're probably not telling the truth because,
or you were passed out.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, I as you knew, I grew up very very close to that site.
Close.
And just a little side story. I've told you this, but I don't know if I've ever mentioned on the podcast before, but I had a friend years ago who lived catty corner to the site.
Okay.
This is long before all the land was bought up to mm-hmm. make the
kind of the park and
the park and yeah, and the amphitheater and all that kind of stuff. So, I remember sitting on her porch and people would just drive up and you just got to imagine as far as the eye could see a field. It was just hay, you know,
right.
grown full height.
Yeah.
And there's just a stone on the ground with a plaque and, you know, saying that the concert was held there. I'm not exaggerating. They pull up in one of those old VW vans. Exactly.
Always in a van.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's, you know, just
with a peace sign on. Yeah. Maybe.
But they pull up there and they just be staring and staring out into space. And I remember sitting there and commenting to my friend, what are they even looking
They're
at?
Reminiscing.
I guess.
Right? I guess. Do you remember that field? And
yeah.
I don't know.
So anyway, it looks nothing like that today. Although I should mention they did not build the amphitheater or the museum on the exact site.
Area.
It's off to the side. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Jimi Hendrix was the highest paid at the concert. He was paid $18,000, which would be the equivalent of $129,000
wow,
today.
Good.
The second of my list actually came, it was tied for third. That was Creedence Clearwater, Creedence Clearwater Revival. They were paid $10,000, which is $71,500 today. The Who, which was your second choice,
yes, who I thought possible,
were ranked 10th. They were the 10th highest act.
Oh, my
They were
gosh.
Paid $6,250, which would be $46,500 today.
Huh.
The Grateful Dead, which, of course,
went on to be very
Famous. You know,
yep.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Deadheads
and
would go.
Longstandingly famous, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Concert after concert people would go to. They were the 17th highest paid act. They were paid $2,500, which is about $18,000 today.
Hmm.
And the lowest from my list was Santana.
Oh,
he was
my
paid
goodness.
$750, or the equivalent of $5,400. I'm telling you, for $5,400, I'll pay Santana right now to come play in my backyard.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if he's listening, there's the offer. No, right. I'm sure he's not, but it's just kind of a joke. But
he's also lasted, really.
Yeah.
Done great.
Yeah. I mean, just a few. I mean, the bottom three below Santana, 27th was Sha Na Na. Remember them?
Yes.
And the other two I haven't heard of, Keith Hartley, and the lowest paid was a band called Quill. But there are others. The second was Blood, Sweat, and Tears. You had the band, Janis Joplin, Jefferson Airplane, Sly and the Family Stone, Richie Havens, Arlo Guthrie, who we did see at the Bethel Woods.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, Bethel Woods. But that's we actually saw him. He was actually, I didn't want to go see him. My brother did. And he was actually really good. I was surprised.
Yeah.
You got Joe Cocker on here and so on. So anyway, Jimi Hendrix was the highest paid act.
Well, I thought it was a chance. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, I guess we'll bring this to a close.
Okay.
I want to thank you for being on this podcast.
Not a problem.
And I'll just remind everybody, to make sure you subscribe through iTunes. Actually, it's Apple Podcasts now or Google Play or whatever.
Right.
And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter. The handle's at Useless Infocast. And let's see, what else have I been up to? Oh, I just got asked to write a special introduction to my Turkish copy of The Flip Side History. So if you don't have a copy of The Flip Side History, make sure you go out and get a copy.
Understand Turkish.
Yeah, and if you understand Turkish, you get a bonus of a little introduction by me, which I have no idea what I'm going to write yet. I have to do that this week.
Okay.
Anyway, thanks everybody for listening and hope to tune in the next time. Bye.
Yep, bye.